Where they go to sleep at night, I wonder why I don't feel the pain. From where the sun is shining bright, but empty shells of lives remain. I know the news will tell me why, and we'll watch others take the fall. But who will hear when someone cries that saving one can save us all? Can you open your heart? Will you give me your hand? Can you look in my eyes? Will you see who I am? The blood sons and the blood of your daughters, the blood of my sisters, the blood of my brothers, the blood of your fathers, the blood of your mothers, all that you own through the blood of another.
See, when I go to sleep,
a song called Blood in the Gold by Peter Buffett. He is best known to most people as the son of Warren Buffett. And unless, of course, you're involved in some of the things that Peter has been involved in, including music, films, many other things, and as an author as well. He is going to be presenting his concert series called Life is What You Make It, A Concert in Conversation with Peter Buffett, which also takes its name from his book, Life is What You Make It, at outside our listening area. Usually I don't do this, but this is going to be up in Chicago. So unless you're hearing us online and happen to live up around there, you'll have to drive up to see this next Tuesday, June 3rd, at North Park University in Chicago, part of the Symposium at the Axelson Center for Nonprofit Management. So this would be particularly of interest, I think, to folks involved in nonprofits, and there are many such in our listening area, certainly. So my guest, Peter Buffett, is with us on the phone right now. Thank you very much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So I referenced, of course, your dad,
right,
and your book. And let's start with your dad, if you don't mind.
Sure, because that's what led to the book, ultimately. Without my dad, it wouldn't have been written. So.
Well, just clarify that. How do you mean? What do you mean when you just said that?
Well, it's, you know, honestly, most people are curious about me, if they, like you said, don't know my musical career and that sort of thing, because I'm Warren Buffett's son. You know, that is kind of a, and actually even that wouldn't be so extraordinary, except for some reason, people keep meeting me and saying, you're Warren Buffett's son, you're so normal. And so that kind of got to me in a good way, probably 10 years ago now, more than that, because I realized that my story, and I was asked to tell it a few times to, you know, wealth management groups and things like that, like, you know, it would matter how I grew up, the values I had, the kind of parents I had, the neighborhood, you know, public education, all these things that to me were normal, but to people's perceptions of who I must be based on who my father is seems rather strange.
And so the book...
Right. So the book, Life is What You Make It, which I always preface in my show by saying easy for me to say, right, because right. My dad is Warren Buffett. But the point is that, in fact, it was the values I grew up with. It was how my parents raised me, the kinds of experiences I had that had nothing to do with wealth, that really allowed me to be me. And again, putting it in relief to who my dad is, it's dramatic, because people just assume, well, if you've got money, everything's set. And it's not just my story. There's a bunch of stories in the book that talk about it, frankly, usually not being money that makes the person.
Well, talk a little bit about what some of those values were that your parents instilled in you.
Well, my wife has figured out the three words that sum it all up, and it's safe, seen, and celebrated. So in other words, I grew up in a house where it was a loving house. My dad seemed to like what he did. We had no idea what it was, but he was happy, and he wasn't spending money, so we knew it wasn't the money. He just enjoyed his work. So we saw that. I had grandparents two blocks away. Their door was always open. I had the same English teacher my mother had in high school, so I had this long public education that was, you know, rooted in community and a neighborhood. And so the safety that comes with that is immeasurable, really. And the older I get, the more I realize how many people don't grow up with that, you know, that fundamental thing. And then the seen and the celebrated is really just the fact that once you're feeling safe, you can express yourself. I started playing piano at a young age, and my mom encouraged it, and I played with friends, and you know, then I went on, fortunately, to build that into a career where I did some things that, you know, showed me I could do it and do it well. And again, those are all based on the people around me, the support I had in terms of human beings, and then belief in myself coming from that solid of a foundation, basically.
You said your mom encouraged you in the piano. What was your dad's role?
My dad's role was really seeing somebody that was so dedicated to what he did, and he was enjoying it so much that you could do that, that you could actually focus on something and make it pay, essentially. And again, I wasn't counting these ridiculous amounts of money he was making, because we didn't see that, but we just saw that we had a roof over our heads and food on the table, and, you know, we could fix the car if it broke down, and, you know, those things matter for sure. And so I kind of, while my mom encouraged the artist in me, my dad sort of represented what you can do if you really are into what you're doing and can focus and have the time to do it.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have an older brother, and the eldest is a sister.
And if we're talking about, in part, forging your own way in life, what sort of way have they forged for themselves? Is it at all like yours?
Well, in its way, I guess it is. My brother is mostly a farmer in Decatur, Illinois, in the middle of the country, but he also is very involved, as we all are, in the philanthropic work now that we have a lot more responsibility there. He's also an amazing photographer, travels all over the world, mostly on philanthropic work, but is also, you know, kind of using his art to bring stories back. And so he's definitely doing something different than my dad. or either of my parents for that matter. And my sister is back in Omaha, has been there for quite some time, and raised her two kids there, and really in a lot of ways took on aspects of my mother's role in Omaha in a really beautiful way. So she's in fact following, you know, kind of more in the footsteps of my mom.
And I should just say, since you mentioned Decatur, that is very much in our listening area, just about an hour from Champaign-Urbana.
I had a feeling it might be.
Yeah, we're only about 50 miles apart here, and lots of things going on there at Milliken University. And
yes, exactly. I played speaking. Milliken University years ago, actually, one of my early shows. That's funny.
Where are you originally from?
Omaha.
You are from Omaha. From
Omaha and from the house that my dad still lives in, you know, which is really the classic him, is that very, you know, steady and direct and consistent and all those wonderful things. And so when I go home, he's still sitting in the room he sat in 1964 when he's reading the paper at night.
Yeah, well, you'd think that he would have bought himself a brand new house many times over, or
maybe
possible. There are others, yeah.
But of course, everyone in your listening area would know that that is pretty classic Midwestern behavior. So it's the only surprising thing is he's got all that money and he still behaves that way.
Of course, we've talked about that you have a music career as well, and we're playing music from a part of it, the more recent part of it. And your presentation, Life is What You Make It, A Concert in Conversation, includes music, it includes video, it includes the conversation part, which you initiate.
Right.
But let's talk a little bit about that career. I'm just looking at the very first paragraph of the official biography of Peter Buffett, and it makes reference to your being, quote, the musical mind behind many of the early MTV bumpers of the 80s. And so what's a bumper?
Yeah, what's that mean exactly? You know, it's so funny. You use language you're used to and you forget, but not everybody is. And it's those funny little 10-second things, which every channel has. You know, they're also called interstitials, but that's a little out there, too.
Well, see, I know that here in radio and TV.
Exactly,
yeah, I know that term.
Right. So it's the same thing. We're trying to, I guess, make the language a little plainer, but at the same time, it gets confusing. But yeah, they're the 10-second logos, basically, of the very, very early days of MTV, really the beginning of it, which is why it was so fun, because we had no idea what we were getting into. You know, it was just a job for me, but you try and do your best on every job, and lo and behold, it's a breakthrough thing.
There they were. So we know you started to play piano when you were much younger and went on to do things in music, but what was the path that led from the piano lessons to the job that had these bumpers created for MTV?
Well, it was, I can't give away too much of my show because I show that path in about 15 minutes with images and stories and jokes and all that stuff.
Good. Well, we'll give you 2 minutes then. How about that?
It'll
be the thumbnail.
It was really, you know, being encouraged always to play the piano, which meant taking and quitting lessons multiple times, thanks to my mother for allowing me to quit and then take them again. From different teachers, and then still not realizing that it was a musical career I was destined for, because I started to play four-handed piano with a friend in high school, and he was so darn good, I just thought, well, forget that, and played for fun. Went off to college, took everything that ended in 101 or ology, and you run out after about a year and a half, and heard a guy playing guitar in a dorm, a friend's dorm, and was just blown away and realized that music was about soul. And even if I wasn't the best piano player in the world, if I was the most soulful one, or at least tried to be, it could work. And I was lucky enough to find out that my grandfather had left us a little bit of money. He left us about $90,000 that my dad gave to me when I think I was 19 or 20. And so I moved up to San Francisco, invested in some equipment, said yes to everything. And one of the things I said yes to was somebody saying, I'm doing these weird little 10-second things. And I'll pay you $1,000 to make 10 seconds of music, which was pretty great.
And hence those bumpers for MTV.
Yeah, and I don't know if I did that inside 2 minutes. I doubt it, but
oh well, it was very close. But at least it's enough to be intriguing, certainly.
Excellent.
To me, and then know how things go from there, which I'll ask you about in a minute. Reminding listeners that my guest here on Live and Local today is Peter Buffett, who is an Emmy Award-winning musician, and he's also a philanthropist and author. And his book called Life is What You Make It has in turn spawned a concert series, we call it a concert in conversation, which he's going to be presenting next Tuesday in Chicago at North Park University at the Axelson Center for Nonprofit Management. It's concluding a symposium that's happening there. So next Tuesday, and he's my guest this portion of the show. We started out, Peter, with a song called Blood Into Gold, and that's an interesting collaboration you have. You want to talk about that a little bit before we hear our next tune?
Sure. It was interesting. It was a very strange collaboration, but it speaks to, and when I speak to college students, I bring this up quite a bit, it speaks to following what's true for you and seeing what happens as opposed to deciding, you know, that this has got to happen in order for anything to matter. So in other words, when I started in music, it was, I'll take any job, I'll do anything I can, nothing is beneath me. It's not, I want to be famous, I want to work with famous people, I want to make a lot of money. So therefore, I took a very long, circuitous path through my career and ended up, I think, at about 50, working with this major hip-hop star, Akon, who's known all over the world. I had no idea who he was. Because he heard a song that I wrote from the heart, like I was talking about before. It was what I felt after I'd taken a trip on the philanthropy side to Liberia and seen what I had seen, and I came home, wrote this song, wrote a couple songs actually, and he said, let's work together. And so when this opportunity came up to write the song about trafficking, I called him again and said, we have to do this, and he agreed. Very strange collaboration.
But successful, I
absolutely
presume.
Something I never would have done without him. It wouldn't have sounded like that without him, and wouldn't have reached the people that it reached without him. So, yeah, very successful on all fronts.
And it had a debut at the UN?
At the UN. Now, I'd like to believe that it was in front of the whole General Assembly. It was not. It was in the General Assembly, and it was in front of a lot of people. And it was in the UN. It was extraordinary. There was an event held there. I forget now. It's been a while who all was there. But it was really, it was amazing to premiere that song in that space.
We have one here called Silence Broken, a very different character to it. Does this come off of, I don't actually have a note of which album some of these songs we have come off of. Where does this one come from, and what's the background to it?
Well, some are just singles, frankly. Mm-hmm. I feel that the album format, except for certain circumstances, is a thing of the past, frankly. And I feel that songs are kind of like fruit. They're best when they're fresh. And so I decided just to put songs out as I'm making them if I feel that, you know, they're ready to be put out in the world. So Silence Broken is one of those. And it was, again, inspired by the philanthropic work, something I never imagined would happen, that I would be having these really deep, intense experiences and then writing songs about them. But of course, that makes perfect sense. I just didn't think about it. And with Silence Broken, my wife and I and some members of our staff at the foundation went to visit a group of girls at an organization called GEMS in Harlem and really heard stories that I'd never really even thought about before, not only heard before, but hadn't really considered, hadn't realized how girls get trafficked and abused, and I'm just intense, real, personal stories. And so I came back and wrote that song because what I realized is that essentially when anybody tells their story, it breaks some kind of a silence around something. Sometimes it's very benign and simple, but other times it's powerful and changes their life. And so it was really a song about the power of speaking out.
It's Silence Broken by Peter Buffett. Here on Live and Local, he's going to be performing his concert Life is What You Make It at North Park University in Chicago next Tuesday. Details to come. Stay tuned. Silence is Broken is the song by Peter Buffett, singing and having written that song and heard here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. Do you write the music and the words to all your songs?
I do, and it's painful.
Which part?
The music part is easy. The music I've been doing since I was probably 4 years old, you know, trying to put the things I hear in my head into my fingers somehow. But the words, oh my goodness, that's the hard part for me.
Well, I guess most of your music until fairly recently was all instrumental, and almost a decade ago, so we're talking not that recent.
Right.
I read that you started to experiment with vocals and a different sort of sound.
Right.
Exactly. Why? And talk about the experimentation a little.
Well, I will tell you something I don't get into too often, but it was simple, really. My life had changed dramatically over the course of a couple years in 2004 and 2005. My mother passed away. My very best friend passed away. I had sort of culminated this 15-year trek towards creating this big theatrical show called Spirit the Seventh Fire that was in its own tent, and it was just this massive undertaking, and it stressed my relationship with my wife to the very finest line of commitment. And so all those things literally came together at a time, and I learned what the phrase "sing your heart out" means. Mm-hmm. I figured that music was the only way I could get kind of back to my center, the relationship with Jennifer, my wife, all things that had culminated in this like 1.5-2 year period. And so I started to sing. That was the experimentation, really, is will this work? If I start singing, what will happen? And sure enough, it really helped everything sort of reclaim itself. I mean, the music really did, in a sense, save a lot of things or reignite a lot of things, all that kind of stuff. Music works. That's what I found out. And singing really works.
So it began as a sort of personal need.
Very much so, yeah.
But as we've heard from the couple of songs we've heard so far, those have now come out of a much less personal need.
Right, which as you're saying it is sort of reminding me that we are all a reflection of the larger thing. And I had to sort of connect back to what I needed personally and reclaim that and then work with my relationships outward. And then you start to look beyond yourself, and I started to see things I could write about that were bigger than me. And so, yeah, it's actually a trajectory that makes perfect sense sort of in the wider world, and that's definitely what happened.
I want to talk a little bit about the philanthropy that you've referenced a number of times. And I don't know what was the order of things here. You've made reference to the foundation, which I assume is the Novo Foundation.
Right.
And you also just referenced this very interesting sounding musical production, Spirit the Seventh Fire, which has a great deal to do with Native American life and music.
Right.
Which preceded which?
Well, that's the perfect description of why when people ask me what I do, I say it's all completely blended together, because the American Indian Show started. That came out of working on Dances with Wolves, which came from reading a book, frankly. I read a book called Son of the Morning Star about the history of essentially the 19th century West and Custer specifically, and it blew my mind. This was in the late 80s. I wrote some music. Kevin Costner heard it. I ended up scoring a scene for Dances with Wolves, which launched me into a whole decade and a half almost of immersion, not so much in the American Indian story, although it definitely started there and was rooted there, but more in westward expansion and what domination and exploitation and control and transaction, all these things that we sort of have been seeing happening over the past 100 years or so, that the American Indian story sort of encapsulates in a lot of ways. And so it was this kind of larger narrative, and I put that into a big theatrical show. And then as the foundation came into being, that information, that way I was kind of seeing the world, played a huge role in, and Jennifer as well, because we were in this together, huge role in how we saw foundation dollars, I guess, working in the world. How could we change the world from domination and exploitation to nurturing cooperation, away from a competitive model, essentially?
So I think you just described it a bit, but can you describe more specifically what Novo Foundation does?
Sure. So with that as sort of its driving force, the overarching narrative there, changing the world to what you might consider to be feminine qualities, and I don't mean this as male and female, but just instead of power and control, which has its place in certain situations, cooperation and nurturing does as well. And so with the foundation, if we want to balance those things out, the first obvious place to go is girls and women. Support girls, give them agency, allow them to take control of their lives, and they'll do the rest, essentially. And that can happen through a variety of ways, education, economic empowerment, legalities around ownership and control of land and all sorts of stuff. And that's the complication in the foundation is what works, what doesn't, where does something work, where does something not work. It goes on and on. But then we also have a few other fields around education and local economies that also we feel will help sort of balance out what seems to be out of whack in the world today.
So how does the foundation work? Do you and Jennifer and others involved in the foundation identify events and issues going on that you want to support or do something about? And or do you let generally people know what the foundation is for and folks come to you and make application, will you support this or that?
It's hopefully both. It's a little harder with the latter because you want to be porous, but you also don't want to be overwhelmed because so many good people are doing good things, and you have to filter it somehow through your own lens. And that's the tricky part about foundations in general, is that somebody's saying, this we can spend money on, this we can't. I mean, because you just can't do it all. And so perceptions, creeping in there, no matter how neutral you kind of want to be to hope you're doing the best good. But again, the best good is, by definition, someone's definition. So you can't. But we do, through our staff and through who our staff knows, the key is always hiring people that are smarter than you. So our staff is plugged in ways we can't be or aren't. And through many networks, we basically try and get our ear as close to the ground as we can, and to us, the ground is people that don't have agency, that aren't being heard, that are somehow being oppressed by a system they had no voice in creating. And so how do you bring those voices up and be heard? And then what do you do with that? How do you start to change systems to work better for more people, essentially?
Well, as somebody who's involved in various non-for-profit organizations, I'm familiar with the desire for support.
Right.
And so I certainly understand that, any foundation needs to define itself as clearly as possible.
Yep.
And do everything that it can within however it has defined itself.
Yeah, exactly.
And of course, your talk next week, your concert. Well, I guess it's a talk and it's a concert.
Right, exactly. And well, except the conversation part is important because what I do is I take questions through the whole show. So I'll stop, or if somebody can just raise their hand and say, hey, what about, or whatever. So I really actually strive to make it a conversation as best as possible.
And it's called Life is What You Make It, a concert and conversation with Peter Buffett.
Yep.
And we're having this conversation with Peter Buffett right now. He's going to be at North Park University in Chicago next Tuesday. And I'm airing it on this program because there are so many folks involved with nonprofits in our listening area, whether management or otherwise. And this is taking place at the conclusion of a symposium at the Axelson Center for Nonprofit Management at North Park University next Tuesday. And certainly folks are welcome to go up and participate. You can check out the website for North Park University, and actually is northpark.com/symposium, and find out how to get in on that. I wanted to play another song here, and this is one that I want to play at least partly because I'm intrigued by the title, which I believe I recognize as also the name of a film by Fellini called Amarcord.
That's correct.
And how did this come to be the name of one of your songs?
Well, I was just like you. I remember the name of this film, and it's not because I was a fan of the film. I'm not sure I've ever seen it, or a Fellini fan for that matter. But I was intrigued by the word, Amarcord. And so I called the song that. Actually, I wrote the song years and years ago, and then it came back in my head, the instrumental. I wrote lyrics to it, stuck with the name, and then the name means essentially I remember, or do you remember, that kind of a thing. I was able to look it up, which is exactly what the song's about. And I did not put that together until about 30 years apart from when I wrote the instrumental to when I wrote the lyrics and then looked at what the title meant. So how about that?
So when it was a title of an instrumental, it was just a title, essentially.
Right. It was just a name I liked, like the name you remembered.
Yeah. And so now it's one of those coincidences that,
yep,
that prove you made the right choice to put the words to this tune.
Yeah, it makes you wonder about everything in terms of the choices you make and why you make them.
Yeah, well, I always thought that when I'm programming concerts, if it's the things you hadn't thought about that you discover later on that support that you made a good program in the first place, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
So
it's the intuition, which is critical.
Yeah, so what was the inspiration to put words to this tune?
Well, it never left me. I mean, I literally wrote that song, I think, in 1981, the music to it. And I could remember it when I sat down in 2005 or 6 or whenever I did. It just, and very few melodies stick that long when they haven't really been written down. And so I thought, okay, this is sticking with me for a reason, and got into it. And just, I really loved the result. It's what I play as an encore, actually, when I have one in a show, which happens occasionally.
So we folks may or may not hear it.
That's correct.
Or some other encore. Who's the female voice with you here?
In Amarcord, that's all me.
That is all you. So this is you falsetto.
Yeah, exactly. And
I kind of wondered if it was.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it was. Well, yep. People can listen,
yep,
and they can at least see what I'm talking about. Amarcord with Peter Buffett here on Live and Local.
It was such a simple time without a point of view. Every door was open. Every thought was new. It seemed so easy then. I just let it be. Darkness in the corners I could never see. Change.
were never shown. And love is all around me. I see it every day. With every new perception, an old one fades away.
Amarcord by Peter Buffett. And as we heard at the outset, the voices there both belong to Peter Buffett, whether it was high or lower. And he's going to be performing his show called Life is What You Make It, a concert and conversation, next Tuesday at North Park University in Chicago. I'll give you that website again coming up. But he's also the author of a book of that same name. It's been translated into many languages. It even has the an endorsement by former President Bill Clinton. I don't know that it has the express endorsement of his father, Warren Buffett, but if somebody is interested in the work of Warren Buffett, you might well be interested in the work of Peter Buffett simply
that's
because
right.
of the connection.
You know, that's a great question. I don't know if anybody's asked me whether he endorsed it, but he did. I just didn't feel it was appropriate to put it on the cover, but he was certainly very appreciative and all for the book.
Well, that was going to be a question I wanted to know. And what's his role in your work now?
Well, he is, this is a great thing I recently realized about him. He is famously, and this is true in his work life as well, laissez-faire. You know, I mean, he really says, look, I believe in you, you're going to do a great job, I'm going to not try and get in the way of you, basically. And he does that with his managers. You know, there are some managers of companies he doesn't talk to for years, and unless they feel compelled to tell him something. And same with us as kids. It was very expressed that we could become whatever we wanted to be, and he would love us no less. And so there were no expectations on you. If you're not a doctor, you're a nobody kind of thing. And even in our philanthropy, and especially in our philanthropy, he's very much like, I trust you guys. You're going to do what you think is best, and I know you're doing your best, and it's a lot easier to make it than it is give it away. So you get to give it away. Good luck. But in a wonderful way. And what I learned from all that is that when you're actually given free rein, you take it way more seriously and respectfully. If somebody puts a bunch of rules around you, you want to break them. But if somebody gives you no rules, you want to kind of live up to, whatever you should live up to, sort of, or live into. And so it's an interesting strategy, I think.
And I gather that this topic of our conversation is at least some of what puts your concert, Life is What You Make It, into a symposium for nonprofit management.
Right, exactly. I think that what we have learned, given really free rein from the ground up, building a foundation that is as large as ours is, if nothing else, an interesting case study. You know, people can look at it and take what they want from it, but it's fairly rare, and I think because of the op-ed I wrote last year, last summer, it also really put definition around my experience and Jennifer's and my experience in the foundation world and some of the opinions we both share.
So that was an op-ed that was in the New York Times. Can you give us an abstract of that?
Sure. The title was The Philanthropic Industrial Complex, which is to say it was an observation of what we see from the vantage point we sit at. You know, it was not an end-all, be-all, and it was not condemning philanthropy really as much as what system is in place that's created a lot of what we're seeing here in philanthropy. And it just felt like at times philanthropic work could be used as sort of another tool in a machinery that's still based on what we're trying to work against, which is domination, exploitation, the capitalist ethic in the bad sense of the word. I'm not, you know, condemning. Again, in the op-ed, I say I'm not calling for an end to capitalism. I'm calling for humanism. You know, it's not about a particular system of anything. Just let's make sure the system is working for as many people as possible.
And how does this generally get applied? Might this generally get applied to nonprofit management? Let's say, for example, some sort of musical arts or arts group. And we've got many of those in our area here.
Yeah, and I think again, the tricky part of all of this is everybody, I think, is doing their best. I start from that premise, and there are many things that need immediate attention for sure. But for instance, with the arts groups, my first frustration is that they need to exist. You know, why do we have a system that has somehow put arts in the category of a charitable activity? You know, if you were in the part of the country you're in, or any part of the country, 300 years ago, people would be singing in the day, they'd be singing in the meals, they'd be singing out the day. Now, that may be an extreme situation in terms of an example, but the point being is that arts should be in the world in so many different ways. And so we need arts groups. You know, the point being is that they are essential to our culture and who we are. But I would also hope that there's an aspect of some arts group that is saying, how can we change this so this doesn't happen anymore? How can we get it in our schools, which I'm sure some of them are, or doing after-school programs, that sort of thing. And then the trick, of course, with any group often is who are you working with, who are your partners, who's your constituency, what are you measuring, how are you measuring it? And as you get into bigger organizations that are working around the globe, that's when you start to get into behavior that almost always happens when it's not in your own backyard. You know, so again, an arts community in your backyard, you would be connected to, you would know what it was doing, you would feel good about. If you're giving to a large organization to help someone in another country, things can start to get really distorted.
And the book is called Life is What You Make It, about following one's passions over conventions, taking up the reins of destiny, living life to the fullest. The concert, Life is What You Make It, a concert and conversation with Peter Buffett, is about those things and more, geared a bit more particularly to the business world, nonprofit world.
Well, yeah, I mean, the fun thing about the show is it's the same show wherever I go, but I sort of lean into different areas of it depending. So if I'm speaking to a university, it's much more about my own personal life path, the values, where, you know, that took me. And then also the philanthropy side, of course, is there as well. When I'm speaking to a community foundation or even more specifically to a group like this, it's much more about, yes, the foundational aspects of my upbringing, but then how those values were brought into the philanthropy and, you know, what I've seen in the world, the questions we have to ask ourselves, that sort of thing. So I sort of lean into the back half of the show because the life is what you make it is actually my life, and it's that trajectory. So it starts very young and with a lot of, again, you know, pictures growing up and old commercials and that sort of thing, but then it gets much more into the philanthropic work.
So Life is What You Make It, and also this concert is what you make it if you are one make of it if you're one who happens to be attending.
Yes, exactly.
It's going to be next Tuesday, June 3rd, at the conclusion of what's called the Symposium at the Axelson Center for Nonprofit Management at North Park University in Chicago. And if you want information on that symposium and how to get into this. It's the website is northpark.com/symposium. Simple as that. If you want more information on Peter Buffett, it's peterbuffett.com. That's B-U-F-F-E-T-T. And it has been a pleasure to talk to you here on Live and Local today.
Thank you so much. Been great to be here.
Tell me a little bit about this song we're going to go out with, Can We Love? What was the genesis for this one?
Well, it's perfect that you would end with that, because I end every show with that.
Ah.
I actually ask everyone, now I don't want anyone to get nervous if they're thinking about going to the show, I ask everyone to sing along by the end of it, and everyone always does. I've played in China, I've played all over the place, and people sing along because of the trajectory of the show. It gets very sort of in your face in terms of some of the issues we face in the world, but then I say there's a way around this thing, and it's through love, and it's really a fun way to end the show. And it frankly started again in the very early days of my singing, basically making sure my wife and I were on the same page with our own relationship, and then again now it's sort of a song to the world. So it went from very personal to very universal.
Peter Buffett, thanks very much for joining us on Live and Local today.
Thanks for having me.
Can
Can We Love, from one of Peter Buffett's live concert performances here on Live and Local on FM 90.9. I'm Kevin Kelly. And with apologies for disappearing right there, our program is made possible with support from the Sousa Archives and Center for American Music, breathing life into the history of our nation's musical past through exhibits, guided tours, and performances at the University of Illinois. More information is available, and visits can be scheduled at 217-333-4577. We have support also from Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, inviting you to visit Promenade, the artfully affordable and exceptionally eclectic shop. More information on upcoming events is on krannertcenter.com. Here are some events you can see and hear live in our listening area over the next couple of days. Tonight at 5:30, coming up very shortly in Normal at the Connie Link Amphitheater, it's the Adam Larson Quintet playing jazz. And at the Iron Post, same time, 5:30 this evening in downtown Urbana, the SSG Trio, Spencer Stevens Gray playing jazz, followed at 8:30 tonight by singer-songwriter Pam Machala. And then there's a jazz jam at 10 o'clock tonight. At Carl Park in Urbana at 6:30 this evening, one of the Neighborhood Nights concerts from the Urbana Park District featuring ESP, an acoustic group, is reported here. And at Lock, Stock, and Barrel in Decatur at 7 o'clock this evening, Billy Gault will perform. Tomorrow night, it's the opening of the Summer Theater Series at the University of Illinois, Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, with The Brothers Size. And we'll be having a preview of that and the rest of the season coming up on Friday's Live and Local. Also tomorrow evening at the Iron Post in Urbana, the Weasel Dreams Sextet played jazz Thursday, 7 o'clock. On tomorrow's Live and Local, I will welcome Strings Attached, a string band that is headed by Bob Pierce, who also is the guy who coordinates the music series at Kickapoo Landing in Oakwood at Kickapoo State Park. And that music series well underway. Friday night, Black Ridge Road will be performing there, 5:30. And Strings Attached joining us on tomorrow's show. We'll hear an idea of some of the other groups that are coming to the program. And I'll also talk with David Commande of the Heartland Festival Orchestra, based in Peoria. They're giving the final concert of their season Saturday night at Five Points in Washington, Illinois. So that's tomorrow's Live and Local, and hope you'll be able to join us for that. It's a pleasure to have you with us today, and I'll be back tomorrow 4 o'clock. Mostly cloudy tonight, 40% chance of showers and thunderstorms, low 65. Tomorrow, chance of showers and thunderstorms in the morning, numerous showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon, the high 85. This is 90.9 WYL FM and HD Urbana with translator W293 AF Danville, NPR Classical Music and More for Central Illinois.